This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
For people prone to depression, especially if the depression is triggered by stress, this is probably a really difficult period. That's one of the things I'm going to talk about with my guest, John Moe, who you might know from his public radio podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, which is also the name of his new book. He's a humorist who's dealt with clinical depression much of his life. On his podcast, he interviews people, mostly comics, who have depression. In his book, he writes about his own depression and the history of mental illness in his family. His older brother died by suicide. Throughout the book, Moe quotes relevant passages of his interviews with comics. In the preface, he writes that the book is about how he's been tortured by depression, but also found the absurd humor in it. John Moe, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your depression is triggered by stress. That's what you write in your book. So is the pandemic triggering your depression?
My depression wants to flare up because of the pandemic, and it's a matter of taking what I've learned over the years of how to manage it and diverting it. And it takes more conscious effort than normal, but I'm able to keep it pretty well at bay. So when I feel my mind kind of going to some dark places and starting to distort reality, I fortunately now have the skills to spot that and blow the whistle on it and get to a better place.
Can you give us an example of a distortion that you've prevented from getting out of control and how you did it?
Sure. So cognitive distortions kind of go with a lot of depression, and it's a warping of reality. So if I see the figures of how many people have contracted COVID-19, how many people have died, my brain wants to say, you're next. My brain wants to say, this means everybody will get it. My brain is telling me that it's never going to get any better. And so I can spot that, and I can say, wait a minute, there's data, there's modeling, and there are scientists on the ground looking into this, and this is what they say. And so I can counteract the extrapolation that always kind of catapults me forward to the worst possible future place, and I can counteract that with facts and with science.
How are you dealing with, like, phobia about germs? You know, phobia, like, I don't know if you're going out or if your teenage children are going out or your wife, but, you know, what a lot of people are dealing with is that then you come in, maybe you've brought some groceries. Do you have to, like, sterilize them first? Do you have to, like, wipe your keys with alcohol? That kind of thing can easily kind of go into, like, OCD kind of behavior. So if you're prone to OCD, like, this is a really rough time. So are you dealing with that too?
I've never had much of a germ phobia, so that's been a bit of a blessing in all this. I do sort of common sense kinds of things. I wear a mask. I don't go out a lot. We'll go for a walk with the dogs, but if other people are coming too close, we hike the masks up. And so that's actually going okay. I mean, the part where I do get a little unnerved is if I do go to a grocery store to get something or, you know, stock up, and I see other people not playing by the rules as much. It starts to make me very nervous. And it starts to make me nervous in a grocery store too, when other people seem to be acting like this isn't a big deal, because I'm pretty well set in my view on how big a deal I want this to be. And when I see some dissonance to that, it gets a little woogity on my end.
Are you concerned about how your depression or being prone to depression is affecting your wife or your teenage children while you're all kind of stuck in the house together?
We talk about it a lot in our family, all things about mental health. It's kind of a company policy around here is to be open and talk about what's going on and talk about if there's an issue that needs to be addressed with professional help, if there's an issue that we can address just through our own knowledge. I mean, my wife and I have tried to approach mental health in the same way we would an ear infection or a sprained ankle. Like, let's get this out. Let's address it. Let's figure out what we can do about it, what we need to do about it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, I was saying the other day that if 6 months ago somebody had said, hey, you're going to be pretty much locked up in the house together, you know, you, your wife, the three kids, one of whom is home from his freshman year of college that he was excited to get to. The other two are home from their school that they love. And you're going to be locked up for an indefinite period of time. I would say, oh, so we'll all be dead within 5 days, 4 days? You know, exactly how will they find us and in what positions? And so by that standard, I think we're doing great. And so we're trying to kind of recognize the reality and the when the breakdowns come, we try to say, yeah, of course. You know, we're not trying to say, no, cheer up, be happy. You know, be happy at least you're healthy. Because it's just not really helpful. You can have perspective, but you have to recognize the pain that you're in, because pain is pain, and it's relative to the circumstances of your own life.
When you're in pain or depressed, how does that affect how you deal with other people, like in this instance with your family? Do you get more short-tempered? Do you get angry or sullen?
I can. Again, it's the kind of thing I need to keep in check. And so a big part of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the therapy that I've been working with for a while now and having a lot of success, is the recognition that your thoughts and your behavior are two different things. Like, just because you feel something doesn't mean you have to behave in a certain way. You are not in control of the emotions that come to you, but you're in control of how you choose to act with those emotions in your system. So I might feel like, you know, throwing a lamp against a wall, but I recognize that it's my choice whether to throw that lamp or not. That's been helping a lot. But, you know, it's not a perfect system. I still get short-tempered. I try to say, okay, I'm getting very short-tempered now. I think I'm going to go for a walk around the block. You know, it doesn't stop me from feeling those things. I just try to control the actions that result.
You are so immersed in thinking about and writing about and talking to people about depression. What are you hearing from other people who are living through the pandemic and are prone to depression?
A big thing I'm hearing is about people forgetting to take their meds because their routine is completely disrupted. So if they had been in a situation where you take your meds before you get in the car to go to work, and they're never going to get in their car to go to work for the next while, then they might forget to take their meds. I've had a couple of days where it's just going to be a sweatpants day. So if you associate taking your meds with getting dressed in a professional way, then that can fall off. And I've paid the price for that. But a big thing I've been hearing is a fair number of depressed people doing miraculously okay through this, because we've been preparing for this for a long time. This is the world that a lot of saddies, as I call them in the book, have been living for a while. This idea that there is doom around the corner and it's going to get you and it's going to be terrible and everything is just going to end in ruin. That's been our thinking all along. And so in this case, it has a name. It has a spiky molecule that looks like a Christmas tree ornament, and it's being recognized by everybody. So in some ways, everybody is now seeing the monster under the bed that we've been seeing all along, that everybody has been telling us isn't real. So I've talked to a fair number of people who are like, yeah, this was the drill. All along. I saw a tweet yesterday that said, all you need to do is admit that depressed people were right all along and thank us for our service.
It's interesting. So you're not a survivalist in the sense that you've been stacking like canned goods in the basement and things like that, but you've been preparing, you know, mentally for catastrophe and seeing catastrophe around the corner all your life.
I've always assumed things are going to end badly. And no, we're not survivalists. My wife and I have talked about it. Like, if the zombie apocalypse comes, we're going to be those people taken out in the first 5 minutes of that movie. There's, you know, we're the extras in that particular film. But no, I mean, we aren't all that surprised by it. I mean, we as people with depression, because yeah, like I've had this almost subconscious assumption that eventually my kids will stop speaking to me, my wife will be exasperated, and I'll be living in a Walmart parking lot. And I don't consciously believe that. Like, I have ample evidence to suggest that it isn't so. And with good treatment that I've had, I can laugh about it now, but there is still a part of my brain that says, yeah, you're heading for the Walmart parking lot, though. You know, you're going to be in an old Celica sleeping in the back seat. And that voice is still there. It's properly restrained. It's properly consigned to the ridiculous, but it can't really be eradicated.
So in retrospect, looking back on your life so far, what do you think were the first signs of depression?
It started for me in junior high school, and it was this kind of tidal wave that hit right around the time of puberty. So I've never really known how much one contributed to the other, because they're both kind of mental upheaval moments. But it took the form of a sort of fear that had no source to it. I just knew something was wrong. I mean, I was crying uncontrollably, but not coming from a source of something that had directly made me sad. It might have been a little something that set me off, but then I just couldn't stop crying. It was like there was something wrong with my tear ducts. And it matched a sort of deeper terror and sadness that I was feeling. I had no words for it. I just knew that something was wrong. But then I could see my peers going about their day, and teachers, and, you know, society was continuing along. And I thought, this is shameful. There's something wrong with me, but it's so strange. It's so unknown that I had better keep it to myself. And so it was this secret that I held, that I was disturbed, crazy, alien, something like that. The only association I had of mental illness was from Bugs Bunny cartoons, which is that eventually you'll be in a straitjacket in a padded room thinking you're Napoleon. And I didn't want to be taken away from my family. I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want to, you know, be institutionalized. So I thought, I better keep it a secret. But it was just this unsourced terror that I had.
That's a real burden, having this terror that you can't talk about, because then you think you'll be institutionalized.
Yeah, it was a secret, and I felt a need to keep that secret. And it led to a lot of kind of hyper-achieving mentality. So I joined every activity at school. I tried to be the friendliest, most outgoing kid I could, thinking that that could be medicinal and counteract it.
But the depression didn't care.
No, depression doesn't care. It's not about something. It's not about something that made you sad. It just is. And so it's an illogical condition. So applying logic to it is just is farcical.
You know, in your book, you describe having suicidal thoughts at a pretty young age, and that you kept thinking about nothingness, longing for the void. I was wondering if you could describe what that feeling is, and how you've now learned to control it.
They say this is pretty common with a lot of people who attempt suicide, is it's not so much that they want to stop living, it's just that they're so exhausted from, I guess, the noise that their minds are making, the agitation, the constant kind of banging around. And that's how it felt for me, is I just wanted it to stop. I wanted to not have to manage the world in the way I was anymore, because it was too much. And I talked with Maria Bamford, the comedian, and when she was suicidal, she said, you know that if you do this, if you do die, there won't be relief from all this agitation. You won't feel peaceful. You just won't feel. And that's been echoed a lot from guests.
So this is probably a good time to pause and give a couple of ways to get in touch with someone for help if you're having thoughts of suicide. So there's a phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that's 800-273-TALK or 800-273-8255. And then there's also a way you can text, and that's the crisis text line, and you would text HOME, the word HOME, to 741-741. So again, you would text HOME to 741-741. Did people used to tell you to cheer up, and how would you deal with that?
I would try. I would think that was a really good plan. My dad, and God bless him, I loved him and he loved me, and we had a lot of wonderful times together. One of his lines was, snap out of it. And I really believe that was something I could do. That if I just, like, I wasn't able to do it, but I thought, well, that was possible if I could just cheer up and snap out of it. And it's really, it's well-meaning idiocy by people who've never had to deal with an actual mental disorder to think that it can be repaired by something like that. You know, I always say it's like, you know, you wouldn't tell someone with leukemia to just, like, you know, just go for a walk and I bet that'll clear the leukemia right up. You know, if you smiled more, you wouldn't have such a broken leg. I try to see it as well intentioned, but it's hard not to see it as careless ignorance at the same time.
Are you still on antidepressants? I know you were prescribed it after you were diagnosed with depression.
Yeah, I still am.
Do you find them helpful? Like, how do you weigh the positive therapeutic impact of them with any possible side effects?
The side effects are nothing compared to what I would be without them. I think it's very valuable to keep an eye on them, keep an eye on how they're working in your system, because I have had the experience of something working really well for a long time and then suddenly not. It just falls apart, and then I've had to switch to something else. I've been on the same regimen now for many years, and it doesn't make me, like, giddy, happy, like delirious at all. It just gets me to the same point where the normal people already are. It gets me to a point where I have the capacity for happiness and sadness and every other emotion, but it works. It just catches me up to how people who don't need this kind of thing can produce naturally. And so to me, it's no different than a diabetic with insulin or a heart patient with Lipitor. It just allows me to live a normal life.
I find humor very helpful, because comics are always, like, the good comics are so smart and so perceptive, and they'll give words to something I'm feeling that I don't have the words for, and I'll go, oh yeah, that's what it is. And somebody else feels that way too, and that makes me feel good. So with your depression, writing about it and sometimes being funny about it, as you manage to do in many parts of your book, is it helpful to you to turn it into humor, or is that just, that's just the way it is and it's not especially helpful? It just comes out that way.
I think humor allows you to see the same world everybody sees, but in a new way. and in a new perspective. And I think that's part of the grand intelligence of comedy. And so in doing that, it can bust me out of seeing things in a depressive way, which might be my tendency in that moment. So if I can make a joke about it, it becomes, in fact, a new world, and I have this superpower to go world to world, perspective to perspective. And that's emboldening, and that gives me strength. And so that's a strength that indirectly comes from the depression. I want to say, I think a big reason for the success of our podcast is because we have comedians in large part and lyricists talking about what depression is. And like you say, they can put words to the thing. And it's the old comedy cliche. They're saying what we're all thinking. And when that connection happens with that economy of words and that intelligence of words that a good comedian has, then suddenly the audience member is not alone in that weird alien space, but they're part of a club with this funny person on stage and the other people laughing, and suddenly there's safety in numbers. And I think the laugh that then follows from that audience member is a laugh of relief. And I think that's where the exhalation of breath that forms a laugh is almost a form of a relieved sigh.
Well, John, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. Appreciate your openness, and thank you.
It is my pleasure and an honor, and I've dreamed of talking to you in this setting for much of my adult life.
Thank you for saying that. I wish you good health, and I mean that physically and mentally. Stay well, and I wish you the best. John Moe's new memoir is called The Hilarious World of Depression, which is also the name of his podcast. Rock critic Ken Tucker says, The Quartet X was the greatest band to emerge from the LA punk scene in the 1980s, and that the band's new album, Alphabet Land, can take its place alongside the best work they've ever done. Alphabet Land is X's first album of new material with the band's original lineup in 35 years. Ken says it's proof that getting older doesn't mean being less passionate.
Listen to that. The hammering beat of the drums by DJ Bonebreak, the razor slash guitar riffing of Billy Zoom, the sweet and sour harmonies of John Doe and Exene Cervenka. Yes, X, the greatest Los Angeles band to emerge from punk rock, is back. The music on this new album, Alphabet Land, is the sound of X snatching back its past in order to fuel the music of its future. When X first emerged in the late 1970s, it was a mixture of influences at once unique and familiar. Exene and John Doe met at poetry readings at Beyond Baroque, a bookstore and performance space in Venice, California. The two of them, poets turned songwriting collaborators who were also briefly married, shared a literary sensibility akin to the beat poets of the 1950s. That same decade inspired Billy Zoom, who had played in throwback rockabilly bands. What made them punk was their vehemence, their concise bluntness, their contempt for the fat cat decadence and oversensitivity of the Los Angeles music industry all around them. X didn't sound like anyone else, and the band knew that that meant they were on the right track. Like a lot of bands, X had a big creative surge at the start of their career. They cut their first four albums, all of them excellent, some of them great, in 3 years. Then followed a period of creative and commercial struggle, a burnout and a breakup, other projects, and silence. The new material doesn't have a trace of nostalgia or a slackening of intensity. If anything, the words, the guitars, and the drums possess a go-for-broke urgency, a feeling of, if not now, when? Recorded shortly before our present situation shut everything down, Alphabet Land dramatizes one widespread reaction to the current moment. The feeling that if you're ever going to get something done, do it now and don't waste time. I was lucky enough to be living in Los Angeles when X first got together, and I spent many a happy evening slipping on and off various LA freeways to hunt down the tiny night spots, Knights of Columbus meeting halls, and the abandoned buildings that X found to perform in the days before they were signed to a record label. I would look around these small, hot, cramped rooms and think, why isn't everyone in the world here? Who would not love this music? 40-plus years later, John and Xene and DJ Bonebreaker in their 60s. Billy Zoom is in his 70s. I listen to this new music, and now I think, aren't we lucky to have this gift once again?
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed X's new album, Alphabet Land. Our next guest, Alia Valtz, writes that before she could spell her own name, she knew she was from an outlaw family. In the late 70s, when she was a baby and a toddler, her parents had a roaring business baking and selling marijuana-laced brownies, thousands a month, to hippies, artists, office workers, and activists in San Francisco. Valtz often made the rounds with her mother, selling their brownies to grateful customers every Friday. As colorful as that sounds, and it was, it's no less interesting than another story told in her new memoir, the tale of her parents' relationship, two free-spirited psychics who made their way in a city of enormous cultural and social change. Alia Valtz's new memoir is called Home Baked, My Mom, Marijuana, and the Stoning of San Francisco. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Alia Valtz, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is in part about the city of San Francisco, and your mom was there, I guess, in the mid and late 70s. It was a, a city undergoing remarkable change. Through all this, there was your mom with Sticky Fingers brownies, the marijuana-laced brownies, which at its height was, you know, moving something like 2,800 brownies a week. Your mom and an interesting crew of others that distributed these. What's interesting is that this wasn't the kind of operation where you'd knock on a door and get a password. Explain how this enterprise connected with its customers.
My mom came up with this really innovative business plan where she sold exclusively to people on the job. So she would go around to boutiques and restaurants and real estate offices and even medical offices and only sell to the people who were working. They would buy at large volume and then redistribute the brownies through their own social circles. And in this way, the brownies were really all over town by late 1977, I think, is when they were doing 10,000 brownies a month. It was smart in that there was no fixed location for police to find. The brownies seemed to come from everywhere. And at the same time, it enabled them to reach all of the little culture pockets that were flourishing in the late 70s.
You were born while the business was going, and after your mom recovered from the birth, she started bringing you along on her deliveries. What was that like? What did you learn about how she carried you, kind of how you fit into this whole thing?
My mom, from the beginning, she just sort of took me everywhere. And so in the early days of Sticky Fingers, this meant that I went on brownie runs with her. First, she had me in a front carrier, then on a jerry carrier, and eventually in the stroller. And she would hang duffel bags of brownies from the back bars of the stroller because they were very heavy. So she would use the stroller to transport the brownies. And we'd go from business to business. And her customers just absolutely adored me and fawned over me. So I was very little. Obviously, I don't remember much clearly from this period, but I do have these flashes of memory, and there's a certain feeling that comes to me when I think of it. It was a very exuberant period in the city, and especially in the Castro, where my mom was mostly working. And there was, I think, a lot of cheek pinching and fawning and a lot of joy around it is the feeling that I get anyway.
The business was still going when you were a toddler, and I guess into kindergarten, right?
Yes. Well, in some form or another, it continued until I was an adult. But this original iteration carried on until about second or third grade.
Which meant that you as a kid had to keep a really big, important secret, a family secret. Do you remember being told what the stakes were or how you knew?
No, and I know that seems strange, but it was something that I learned so young that I don't have a specific memory about it. It was always who we are. So I had this understanding of my family as an outlaw family from the very beginning.
And did you know that that could mean prison and, you know, foster care for you? Or?
To an extent. My parents weren't trying to scare me with it, but from a practical standpoint, they needed me to understand that what we were doing was illegal and that if I told anyone, including other children, who might tell an adult, it could have very serious consequences for our family. So I did know from the very beginning that if I told anyone what my parents really did, that they could go to prison.
And do you remember ever finding that hard as you got a little older and had friends?
Not in a very conscious way, although I think it did affect me. I was a child who always enjoyed hanging out with adults and was awkward around other children, and I didn't have a lot of friends growing up. As an adult, I look back at it and wonder how much of that might have come out of the idea of carrying a big secret and how that makes you build walls around it and how that makes you shut down in some ways.
You know, you write in the book that brownie crumbs blanketed the floor where you played. Between secondhand smoke, secret finger swipes of batter, and stolen crumbs, the tots probably consumed a significant amount of cannabis. And there was some drug use among your parents and their friends beyond marijuana, you know, a lot of cocaine. You know, there are people who would be appalled reading this. What's your take on this? Did you ever feel like any of this seemed irresponsible in retrospect?
In retrospect, sure, of course. I feel in general that marijuana is relatively harmless. It's certainly not something that should be consumed by children. And I want to be clear that I don't think I was tottering around stoned during my childhood. I was certainly discouraged from consuming marijuana as a kid. It was grown-up stuff. That was something that I understood. But it was around. It was so much a part of the environment that it would be unreasonable to assume that I didn't inhale it as secondhand smoke. And of course, the brownies taste like chocolate, so I'm sure I snuck some. But it's not like I was, you know, it's not like my parents were feeding me pot brownies. I want to be really clear about that. Where I think it might be more damaging is with the harder drugs. Cocaine is a substance that alters one's personality in a fairly significant way. So there's that. But I also want to say that all of the kids growing up in the Sticky Fingers warehouse came out just fine. We're all responsible adults and contributors to society. So,
And it sounds like
I don't want to be an apologist either. So, you know, clearly this was not an ideal situation.
On the other hand, I mean, it sounds like you felt very much loved and accepted, which probably has a lot more to do with how a kid grows up than what they necessarily inhale or eat.
Absolutely. I want to say that I was so well cared for and surrounded by love and affection. I was not left to run wild. I was looked after, basically at my mom's hip through my entire childhood. So there's no neglect in that.
You know, the relationship between your parents, as described in the book, is just fascinating. These are two really interesting people. And this is a very intimate portrait of them, their courtship, their marriage, involving events that were, in many cases, before you were born. And I know you did lots of interviews. I'm wondering what it was like to kind of get in your parents' heads, your parents in their 20s' heads, and kind of almost like kind of reconstructing a 360-degree view of your early life, a little at a time.
So I have a very intimate relationship with my mom, and it's nothing unusual for us to talk about her very personal feelings, about things both from the past and today. But I started this book having been estranged from my dad for many, many years. And really, for the first couple drafts, I didn't ask his side of the story because I didn't know how. I finally realized that I could not write an honest book without spending as much time on his thoughts and feelings and motives as I had with my mom. And what surprised me so much is how ready he was to go there. We dug through boxes together. We talked about some of his actions from back in the day that were really hurtful to other people. And he was, I think, very brave about it, acknowledging his role in it, and also having a certain curiosity himself about both how he had acted and what drove him to act that way.
You write about the first night they had sex, which is interesting both because you know about it, but also for what happened during the night. Tell us about this.
How awkward is that, writing about your parents having sex? I tried to skip it in my writing group. That's wonderful. Kept saying, look, you can't cop out on this. But what's interesting, so my father is a grand mal epileptic. And my mom didn't know he was an epileptic. They had slept together for the first time. In the middle of the night, my mom wakes up and the bed is shaking like crazy. Here we are in San Francisco. She thinks it's an earthquake. She sits up, realizes that nothing else in the room is moving, that it's Doug shaking wildly in bed. And she thought he might be having a drug overdose. But then he stopped and was sleeping calmly. And it wasn't until weeks later that he told her he had grand mal epilepsy and he'd had an epileptic seizure in the middle of the night.
Now, your parents were really interested in the occult. Both, you know, psychics, I think. They thought of themselves as psychics. Your mom read tarot cards. Your dad was a graduate of the Berkeley Psychic Institute. He, at some point, describes a vision that he has for a child. You want to describe this?
Yes, and it was very early in their dating, in fact. He told my mom at dinner that he was carrying a child, and she's like, what are you talking about? But he explained that he was carrying a spirit child. This is a spirit that he felt was traveling with him and waiting to be born into the world. Ostensibly, this is me. My mom, upon receiving this information after only dating the guy for 3 weeks, was a little taken aback. She wasn't looking to have a child. So there became a little push-pull between them for a while around the idea of this spirit child, which is obviously kind of a crazy thing to write about years after the fact, but I wanted to be true to my parents' visions of what was going on in their lives.
Right. And so he actually, the night of conception, at least he thinks, he told your mom, okay, that's it, you're pregnant. And I guess they both expected that the spirit child was on its way to the earth. Do you want to share that?
Sure. And I want to say that my mom also confirms and describes that my dad identified the moment of conception and didn't even bother getting a pregnancy test. She believed him, and it turned out that he was right. She began to show. It became obvious. So that is a kind of a story, kind of a myth that I grew up with. I don't know how many people have these really high and magical myths about their births, but I sure had one. My dad, however, was convinced that I was going to be a boy. Absolutely certain. And because he'd been right about everything else, my mom went along with it too.
The description of the delivery is really something. I mean, your mom wanted a natural childbirth, and it turns out you were breached. And it was long and arduous and painful. And then the doctor declares she's a girl.
Yeah.
What was your dad's reaction to this? I mean, he was so sure.
I think it was a blow to him. I think it was a blow to his ego. And the story that I had grown up with in my family, and I'm not even sure when I was told this, but was that he left the hospital and went to a gay bathhouse and spent the day there, which is a difficult moment to begin with. That was one of the more challenging conversations I had with my father in writing this book, I have to admit.
You said that was the story in your family. Your mom didn't know it at the time, right?
No, but she found out. So apparently what happened is that my dad, who can't keep a secret, told Cheryl, the other salesperson, at a point. He just had to get it off his chest. And I think that she told my mom. And then he, later on, during a big fight, he told her in an angry way. So my mom found out fairly shortly thereafter. This wasn't something I was told about as a kid, but I think as a teenager was when I found out. And it is the kind of story that sticks in your craw.
This operation got pretty big. Your mom was moving something like 2,800 brownies a week at its height. How did she manage the risk? I mean, this was, after all, a class one narcotic, you know. These were felonies every day or every week. How did she manage the risk of it?
Okay, so this is kind of I want to say a ridiculous part of the story, although I think my parents would disagree. But my mom, both of my parents actually, believed strongly in the occult and specifically the I Ching, which is a 4,000-year-old Chinese divination method rooted in Taoism and Confucianism. And you would consult it in the way that you might consult tarot cards. And my mom believed wholeheartedly in this practice. And so every week she would throw the I Ching coins and ask about their safety and ask about the risk. And she always did what the I Ching said. I mean, the business opened following an I Ching hexagram, There was a point when the business closed following an I Ching hexagram. There was no question too big or too small to run past the I Ching.
You're in San Francisco today when the rules are all so different. I don't know, just reflect on that, how different it is, the attitude towards cannabis and its availability.
Well, yeah, San Francisco has changed quite a bit. With respect to cannabis, it is now legal for adult use, and San Francisco and then California were first in denoting cannabis as an essential business during coronavirus, which was a watershed moment. Nothing like that has happened before. So cannabis is very accessible to people. I feel that, at least for adults, that it should be. I think this is a good thing. But the culture has changed so much around it in ways that I find very heartbreaking. So for, you know, my mom had the first really high volume delivery service. Now you can use an app to summon a company like Ease, and a complete stranger will show up to your door with a lanyard. You don't exchange more than five words, and you pay for it with a debit card. The community aspect has completely run out of the process. The current cannabis laws are also extremely harmful to small farmers who were the ones who kept this all going during the 70s and 80s. So some of the changes have really stripped the community building feelings out of it. At the same time, I'm glad that people have access, especially those who use it for medicinal purposes.
Well, Alia Volz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It has been an absolute pleasure, Dave.
Alia Volz spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Her new memoir is called Home Baked: My Mom, Marijuana, and the Stoning of San Francisco.